Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. Back in August of this year, Russia's attack on the Republic of Georgia, the tiny Eastern European country to its east, grabbed many headlines in this country. My guest is Irakli Kababadze, one of Georgia's leading contemporary writers and human rights activists. In 1988, Kababadze became involved in the student political movement for liberation of Georgia from Soviet rule. He is a founding member and chair of the Egalitarian Institute, a well-known human rights advocacy organization in Georgia. Because of threats of violence in response to his writing and activism, he has lived in exile here in the United States since January of 2007. He's currently writer-in-residence with Ithaca City of Asylum and a visiting fellow in the Peace Studies program at Cornell University. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, you were born in 1969 and grew up in a family that fought the Soviet Empire from the beginning. So did you become politicized as a very young kid?
Well, first of all, being born in 1969 is very symbolic to me. It's a year of Woodstock, and but it was the end of 1960s was really active time. Of course, all intelligentsia, as you call it, Soviet educated class was almost all of it was kind of a dissident, and dissidents were there. So, yes, definitely, I grew up within the atmosphere. My father was a philosopher, and my mother was is still a film critic, and of course they were very much against the Soviet totalitarian system and imperialism in general. So that's not to be surprised with this, but many of the intellectuals were against the Soviet system, of course.
And do you remember conversations when you were a kid? Did they bring you into political discussions when you finally got a little bit older?
Well, absolutely. I learned, as a matter of fact, I learned lots of things on the kitchen table or on the living room table, where they were talking about those issues all the time.
And I understand you began writing at the age of 12. Do you remember what you were writing about at that young of an age?
Yeah, the first of my writing was about the damage done by industrial civilization.
Really? You are your parents' son, aren't
you? Everyone really laughed at this. It was my father. My father was a philosopher who wrote, was a very good friend of Heinrich Böll, and he was considered by Georgian Greens as an ideological, one of our ideological fathers, together with Vajab Shavela of their movement. So he was writing about that a lot, and he was discussing this at the tables a lot. So the industry is moving in and hurting our environment and all those things. So I just really picked it up, and then I wrote the short story about industrial civilization and its problems.
So did you present this in school?
Actually, first I presented to my dad and my mom, and they just laughed at it. So they said, oh, this guy is really, really, you are silly. What are you writing about? But after I took it to the school, yes, I was writing things for the school. It was called The Free Theme, yeah.
And then was it okay for you to be writing political commentary at the age of 12 in the schools in Georgia?
It was not okay, of course. But, you know, there were some people, you know, dissidents are always tolerated in some ways by some people who are, who wish they could do it themselves, but, you know, they don't do it. So I was lucky in the school. I had a school director who was really very much helping me out with this. She was a wonderful, very intelligent lady, and she really encouraged dissidents in the school. But, of course, with the condition that we don't go too loud.
And did you listen? Or did you become quite loud even as a teenager?
Once I graduated from my high school, then the period started when I became more loud, when I was a student. And that's when already the perestroika started, and kind of more democratization of the Soviet Empire started, 1987, 1988, 1989. And this was the time when we came out in the streets and we were asking for democracy and independence, and we're fighting a nonviolent struggle for freedom. So that was a different time.
Yeah, and I understand you got involved with some gang activity prior to becoming a student activist. What were the gangs doing?
Yes,
were they political?
So they were not completely political. It was gangs. was a fight over turf and fight over a territory and fight over girls. Basically, it was like honor fights. So I got stabbed a couple of times.
Oh, my goodness.
After that, I really understood that violence is not the response. Now, I was on both sides, of course. When you are in gangs, you are on both sides. The side that beats others up and the side that suffers from beating or stabbing or killing. That's extreme case. So in experiencing being exposed to the gang life in my teenage years, from the age 14 to age 17 approximately, that's when my gang years that's when I started to understand that, you know, this is not the response, the violence. And we need to deal with the gang problem. And actually, my first book, Allegro, or The Chronicle of One Ear, which won the prize of Saskari magazine, is really, really dedicated to the problem of gangs and why young people resort to be going to the gangs and why do they choose to have a lifestyle that they choose drugs and violence as the method of communicating. And there is not just one-term responsibility there. It's a responsibility of a person, of course, but it's a responsibility of society, of course.
Yeah. Well, a lot of those kids are probably disenfranchised by the oppression as well that's happening in your country.
Yes, indeed. And absolutely, there are different aspects of disenfranchisement, and that included a spiritual disenfranchisement as well as material and political disenfranchisement. And they didn't have a voice to express their identity and to express their human desire, basically, to achieve true happiness.
So when you decided to give up violence, was this translated into political work and nonviolent resistance and, you know, the Gandhian idea of civil disobedience? How did you move from gang violence into political disobedience?
Yes, absolutely. That happened in 1988 when we decided to form, me and my friends, Guillaume Galadze, Levan Vasadze, Georgi Margvelashvili, Georgi Chichinadze, and Elis Barmugiri, formed the six of us. Formed a group that was nonviolently opposed to the Soviet rule, and we started to write and talk for democracy. We were very young then; it was like 19 years old, and we started to basically talk about the problems, the structural problems, basically that faced our society, and we started to talk to our generation people. What can we do? What do we need to do to address those problems? And how to solve these problems without violence? And then it translated into a situation where we became one of the strongest organizations that was opposing the youth communist league called Komsomol. So in 1989, we were the only youth organization that opposed Komsomol. And then I was kind of lucky that I was involved in one of the first televised debates between the representative of Communist Youth League and myself. It was held, I believe, in February of 1990. And then the Communist League disintegrated in March or in April, very soon, because there was not much, there was a lot of structure, but not much belief in that system anymore. So right now, we remember that time that we embraced nonviolent approach. We were guided to it by Merab Kostava, a famous Georgian dissident, and a wonderful guy who was in Gulag for more than 10 years.
Oh,
an incredible guy.
Did you take any of this idea of nonviolence and have boycotts? And did you translate this into actual nonviolent action?
Absolutely.
Besides writing and talking?
Absolutely.
To tell us what
tactics? We have done lots of boycotts, and we have done lots of strikes and lots of hunger strikes and lots of sit-in campaigns during the liberation movement under the leadership of Merab Kostava and other leaders of Georgian independence movement, 1988, 1989, and 1990. Those 3 years were basically very important in independence movement. And Georgia gained its independence formally in 1991. Of course, we were beaten up by Russian soldiers a number of times.
I was going to bring that up. You got beaten up quite severely, didn't you?
Number of times.
And then this was during protests or boycotts? What were you doing?
In April of 1989, April 9th of 1989, we had this big peaceful rally for independence of Georgia. And Russian troops came in and they started to squash 4,000 people in the middle of the night. It was 4 a.m. and they started to do that. And in the process of really beating us up and really abusing their power, they killed 16 women and 4 men.
Oh, geez.
And I was there too. I was beaten very severely and I had a concussion and all this. But, you know, there were people who suffered even more than me. And there was a 71-year-old woman who died after that violence. And that was also a very important point in my life. I was just 20 years old, and I just understood that, you know, violence is so horrible. And especially it is horrible when it's used by the state.
Yeah, yeah. During that time when you were being beaten up and watching people getting killed to try to, you know, gather their freedom, did you ever feel like giving up?
Never.
Never?
Never, of course not. Of course not. I mean, I felt, you know, one of the feelings is that I felt disgusted by what the state can do to its own citizens. Mm-hmm. And it's a horror. But on the other hand, you cannot give up. You cannot give the state that power. And states and big corporations, as Noam Chomsky says, those are big monsters of our life. And when they impose violence on civilians, this is the most horrible thing. And what we need to do is we need to constantly, I mean, my inspiration after that was to constantly struggle to redefine the whole notion of the state, of the nation state, of this Weberian nation state into the nonviolent state. I mean, states should not be based on violence.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, now majority of states are based on violence. Maybe except Costa Rica and a couple of other countries.
Mm-hmm.
But we should, in 21st century, now we should progress and see that, you know, when a state uses power against citizens of its own country or other countries, it's a horror. And that should not happen in a civilized world.
Mm-hmm.
So we are just moving towards that new paradigm. We need to do a lot of work. But
Indeed.
But never give up.
Yeah. Now, you're the founder of several human rights organizations in Georgia, the Egalitarian Institute and the Civil Disobedience Committee. What were you doing under the guise of these organizations?
This was later. This was about 2002, 2003, and 2006 later.
Mm-hmm.
In 2003, we created the Civil Disobedience Committee, comprised of civilians mostly, to advance the cause of the Rose Revolution and to be able to have a nonviolent change of power, which doesn't happen very often in countries like Georgia. And there were writers and composers, artists, and public figures, not politicians, in that committee. And this committee, the Civil Disobedience Committee, was very instrumental in making sure that no violence occurred in Georgia during the transfer of power from President Shevardnadze to President Gamsakhurdia. To President Saakashvili, I'm sorry. Gamsakhurdia was our first president. I always remember his name also.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Irakli Kababadze. He's a dissident writer from the Republic of Georgia. Now, explain to us what the Rose Revolution was.
Rose Revolution was a wonderful event, I think. It's one of those color level revolutions, so-called, nonviolent revolt by people, which culminated with the social change and transformation, basically the political change in
and
power.
And that's when you were able to have a democratically elected president, correct? After the Rose Revolution, was that?
Well, actually, it's not completely like this. Mm-hmm. It was just, it was Georgia had so-called democratic elections since 1992, but they were not really competitive elections in many cases, because the guy who is right now a president, who is not a big friend of mine, he doesn't really like me too, and I oppose his rule also, was elected by 97% in 2004 as a result of revolution. One of the good things that Rose Revolution did, and that what was wonderful, was nonviolent change of power, which needs to be done. But The other thing is that Georgia doesn't have competitive elections yet. Last elections, presidential elections that were there, were kind of more competitive. Although,
what do you mean by competitive? People running against each other, or were the ballot boxes stuffed, or what do you mean?
Well, ballot boxes are always stuffed there, unfortunately. That's the reality. But the percentages, if one candidate gets 97%, and there are five other candidates, can you imagine how many votes others get?
I understand what you're saying.
And that's not democratic. Well, last elections was 53 against 26, which is also not democratic, but is much more democratic than 97 against 3. So now, I do think Georgia has a long road to go, as well as other post-Soviet countries. And, you know, we need to look at it through the dimension of the democracy in the world. I mean, we need to look at it as a phenomenon of world democracy, when we would have fair elections, and that would be in a way kind of free and fair, not double standards but single standards.
So you're saying this is going to be a long road for
this
democracy
is a long
to
road.
Take hold.
Mm-hmm. This is a long road, but you know we always hope that better things will come. Now there is a woman challenger to our president, and I hope she challenges him and she changes him with the nonviolent democratic means of power. Nino Bourjanadze yesterday declared that she's in opposition and she's forming a big party, and she's trusted by lots of people, and hopefully she will be able to change the power. And I do think that if we have a female leader, it will be even better for the peace purposes, because we are right now surrounded by horrible war.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Now, Emmy Rockley, can I ask you to, I want to have you read one of your poems called Deconstruction Blues. And can you tell us a little bit about it before you read it?
Oh, Deconstruction Blues. I wrote this about 10 years ago, and we were participating in a project which was trying to deal with the social ramifications of gentrification process, and about the disenfranchisement, basically about the problem of how do we deal with the people who don't have a documentation, and they're being kicked out of the houses, and basically poor being in a way suppressed by the rich upper middle class bourgeoisie, if we call it so. And we were trying to do it with community activists here in the United States, and we've done it in Georgia too. Gentrification has been one of the big issues in big cities throughout last 10 years or 12 years. So basically, this was kind of a cry against gentrification.
Okay.
I should read it with my Georgian accent.
Okay.
Okay. It's very different from Georgian United States. Main Street, need some weed. And also it needs to feed people who are pressed by greed. Change ideas of mainstream and to have more decent dream. And we need to scream to challenge power hungry team. Well-to-do elites, defend some ugly deeds. We need to plant good seeds in order not to bleed. Christmas Eve, we are never gonna leave. We are always gonna fight for the basic human right. Would you like to see the Pope? Would you like to buy some soap? Would you like to have some hope? Would you like to smoke some dope? You don't want to be some shark. You just want to make some mark. You just want to go to park and make love to Mary Clark. She's an anthropologist from San Diego University. Main Street, need some weed. And also, it needs to feed those who are oppressed by greed.
Oh, that's great. Now, do you consider, do you think writing makes a big change in a country that's seeking its freedom? Is it influential?
Well, I think it's influential. It's influential where people can read and where people can practice this freedom of
freedom of speech.
Expression, of course. But of course, there's it's always a limitations to all of those things, whether or not we have different types of government. And in Georgia, we had some problems with freedom of expression last 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Now you don't just write poetry, you write plays and short stories. Do you also write political articles?
Yes, I do.
For the newspapers and so on?
Yeah, for Georgian Press, I write. And I've written in English and in Georgian and in Russian, in three languages. But mostly I write in Georgian for different publications. Mostly right now, for my last couple of years, I write for the newspaper of Resonancy.
Uh-huh. And so you've been in exile here in this country for a couple of years now. How are you able to affect change in Georgia from here? How are you navigating that?
I hope I've been able to affect change. And there's not much change going on, unfortunately, positive change.
Mm.
So what we are hoping to do is we put together an initiative of peace zones in Georgia. And not just in Georgia, but in the whole entire South Caucasus. Together with our American and Russian and other friends, we would like to put forward the initiative for peace zones in Georgia. Peace zone.
What does that mean, peace zones?
Which means Georgia is a non-military, non-violent country, which means Georgia should not have a military. And those zones of conflict should be completely demilitarized, and not just demilitarized, but it should be declared a violence-free zone, like it is in different places, including Maladec, Philippines, and Peru-Ecuadorian zone of peace, ecological zone. And we have a number of examples in the world about this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the best example probably is the country of Costa Rica. So we have some examples, very few, but some good, very good examples.
Where it's actually working, yeah.
So we are working very hard together with nonviolent people there, and we understand it's going to require a lot of work. It's not going to happen overnight, of course, but we are going towards that direction. And Rose Revolution, when it happened, it was a great thing for the civil society to be able to do, to force politicians and military not to do any kind of violent intervention. Right now, this is going to take even more event because we need to really, really be able to penetrate the discourse of the major superpowers like Russia and the United States. And hopefully that will be possible, and hopefully this time we'll get good allies within the progressive communities in both the United States, Russia, and most importantly, European Union also.
Mm-hmm. And do you have the ear of this woman that is running for president about these peace zones? Have you talked to her about it?
I have not talked to her, but I think that we can reach her with this concept.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully she will be able to implement this.
Mm-hmm.
But first she needs to
be elected.
She needs to be, yes, she needs to be in power.
Uh-huh. I understand you're also doing some work with Cornell University here in Ithaca. To tell us what you're doing.
Well,
here with the Peace Studies program.
Yes, I'm here with the Peace Studies program, and I'm very, very lucky. Thanks to Ithaca City of Asylum and Cornell University, I've been very lucky being surrounded with wonderful people like Jamie Carlaccio, Kenny Berkowitz, Bridget Meets, and many others. And I've been very lucky to know Mr. Lamar Herron and wonderful writers at the Creative Writing Department. Wonderful people, and also being associated with Matthew Evangelista and Valerie Bunce and Mary Katzenstein and lots of other professors, wonderful people at the Department of Government there and the Peace Studies program, Jonathan Kirshner. Actually, today I had my talk about the peace zone, so that's where the action takes place, actually. That's where we try to talk about this. And I'm going to be writing my paper, occasional paper, about the peace zones. And hopefully this is going to go beyond the academic realm, and we're going to be able to reach, grassroots and decision-making circles. But really, being at Cornell and being in Ithaca is a wonderful experience, and really, really, I appreciate very much the community here that had us, and we feel very lucky, my wife and I.
What do you see as your future? Are you hoping to go back to Georgia and continue your peace work, or are you hoping to go back when freedom has been navigated? How do you see the future?
Of course, we always hope. We always hope that it's going to be... future will be better than present. We always have that hope. And so, absolutely, absolutely, we're looking forward to it. And hopefully things are going to change for the better in a peaceful direction with no violence and nobody dying, even the worst guys, not dying and not, you know, facing very bad circumstances. We would like to go back and being able to continue to work for human rights and peace and all those issues, and also doing some artistic work.
What kind of artistic work?
Writing, performing, and doing a collaborative arts. And what we have done, actually, together with the late Irakli Charviani and Gogi Zozuashvili and Salome Korkotashvili, we started to do this musical kind of thing that is called polyphonic blues. This was an attempt to bring the different songs into one song, because Georgia has been a very multi-ethnic place, not just Georgia, but we live in a very multi-ethnic place in Ithaca. And the polyphonic songs, folk songs that are in Georgia for thousands of years already right now, have this kind of peculiarity there, where you have a different songs in the one song together. So this is kind of a harmony within the diversity. It's little different than multiculturalism. Multiculturalism, of course, they are coinciding. But polyphony means that there is no dominant voice. There is no one voice that dominates. There are different voices saying different things at the same time and creating a harmony at the same time.
Are they using different inflections or different languages? Well, what do you mean
different
by languages, different
voices? Different narratives, different discourses at the same time. And neither of them is dominating. There
but
is
they're
no
not
domination.
Opposed either, right?
They're not
all
opposed.
On the same road?
They're not
way.
Opposed. They might be going at different directions, but that's okay too. They might be talking about different things, and that's okay too. They might be picking up at different tunes, and that's okay too. And, you know, sometimes they sound good, sometimes they might not sound good, but it's not a cacophony. It is a harmony within a diverse group of people and diverse songs. Actually, this is kind of practical implementation of the whole idea of multiculturalism. And basically, how can we sing together? As Derrida was talking about the failure of the Western civilization to reach kind of a common language, you know, while recognizing that diversity is there, we are unable to reach that. But polyphony is basically the attempt to find, you know, every human being has a different voice. So why do we sing with a monolithic voice where one voice is just heard and the others are
left
either
out,
singing on the background or left out completely? So here we have many voices at the same time.
That's great. Well, Irakli Kababadze, we have run out of time. I want to thank you so much for joining us, and we do wish you well for the future. We hope you find peace in your country.
Thank you very much.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes in Corning, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.